You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It's Friday, February 3rd. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. It is our 2023 shortstop preview as we both anticipate things happening. In Eno's case, it's a routine sort of cable upgrade.
Fiber, fiber, fiber.
Yeah, and I think I'm in the point of a baby watch now where it's like, I could get that text from the other room while recording and it'll be
orange alert.
Go. Just, I don't know what happens to the pod if StreamYard just runs forever and you'll get a shot of my laundry basket for like 12 days before my computer dies. But if that's what happens, that's where I win. Right. I probably won't hit the stop button and publish the episode just as a heads up. So we're going to try to get this in. It's one of our favorite positions. Always a lot of fun players to discuss. And as we've done throughout the series, we're breaking everything up by ADP tier, looking at NFBC drafts from this range is probably the late part of January 21st up through February 2nd. So a decent snapshot, about 24 drafts, gives us a good approximation of where these players have been going. Now, top of the board, as you'd expect, is full of shortstops. Trey Turner, sometimes a first overall pick, has an ADP sitting around pick 3. Bobby Witt Jr., Bo Bichette have both been first rounders. Fernando Tatis Jr., maybe the most polarizing player in the entire pool right now, right around that 1-2 turn in a 15-team league, and we're going to lump in Francisco Lindor as part of this group, even though he goes closer to pick 30. So you're talking about a guy that you're getting at the end of round 2, beginning of round 3. I don't know if there's much to say about Trey Turner other than he's in a slightly less desirable lineup, but the Phillies lineup is still good. Like, it's a downgrade compared to what the Dodgers had last year.
Park upgrade?
Yeah, maybe a park upgrade. I think the question a lot of people might have about Turner would be, with bigger bases and new rules on throwing over,
yeah,
could a guy who already runs a lot possibly run more? Could that be one of the outcomes we see with the new rules this year, and could he somehow be even more valuable than he's been throughout his career?
He was one of maybe 10 players in baseball last year that averaged more than one throw over per opportunity, you know, with that, you know, not somebody on second, you know, so et cetera, et cetera. So, that's important because if you throw over once, then the second time you've boxed yourself in a corner. So anybody who averages at least one throw is that much closer to getting that pitcher into the third throw over scenario, where if they throw it over a third time, they have to get him or they give up second on a balk. Which is also interesting for fantasy players because that'll be a balk and not a stolen base.
Should that be corrected?
It's the mechanism they chose. I think the player should be rewarded and it should just be called a stolen base, but he didn't actually steal the base. So there's some technicalities in here, Smokey. So, you know, the thing is, I think you can't call it. That's just a Friday reference. It's Friday. I think you couldn't call it a stolen base because didn't actually steal the base. But it's a little sad that Trey Turner won't get any credit for those.
Oh, man. Here's the scenario. Trey Turner loses 10 stolen bases because he gets so many bases that were balked to him. That would be horrible. I don't think that's going to happen. But we can have these dystopian nightmares if we want to.
I also just recorded, you know, because Rates and Barrels is going to 4 times a week, we are going to do some interviews. And I just recorded an interesting conversation with Stephen Vogt about what it's like from the catcher and run prevention standpoint, what they think is going to happen. He agreed with me that he thought the biggest explosion might be with these sort of tweeners, the 3 to 5 stolen base guys, maybe doubling their stolen base outputs, where you know, he thinks that Trey Turner probably just goes as often as he can, and you know, may not necessarily steal a ton more. I was surprised. Do you know the last 70 stolen base person?
Juan Pierre?
Jacoby Ellsbury.
Oh, yeah, you got the 70?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And there was another one recently. So there's been a couple 70 stolen base people in the 2000s. I thought that had been a really long time ago. So I guess 70 is attainable. I wouldn't like take Trey Turner and be like, okay, I got all my stolen bases.
No. If you're looking for seasons like that since 2000, by the way, Jose Reyes had a 78 steal season in 2007.
Yeah.
Ellsbury had 70. Scott Podsednik had a 12 homer, 70 steal season for the Brewers in 2004. I watched that team.
I wonder if the rules bring back more players like that, because he's exactly the kind of player that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah,
like no power, not really great at getting on base. You know, I wonder if Esteban Ruiz will be a Scott Podsednik.
Yeah, Podsednik hit 12 homers that year and slugged .364. He had a 76 WRC plus.
76 WRC plus. Like, people, they don't exist like that anymore.
not guys that are going to get 700 plate appearances. That's very, very hard to do in the current game. But all of this is to say, I mean, I like Turner a lot. I think he's absolutely in consideration for me if I have that first overall pick. I think one of the arguments against him comes back to the depth at this position. I think shortstop runs 16, 17 players deep, guys that you would trust to be in there every day. You're probably thinking about combinations of these guys.
You know, they're the best athletes on the field. They're the best players. They're good. You should just take them because they're good. I do think there is a place in the shortstop rankings where I'm not as excited and I don't need to get the guy, but you know, so many of these top shortstops also run, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think around sort of down by Bogarts and Correa, I like them as players, but they don't steal. And so, you know, maybe that's where depth can come into play, and I can just wait onto like later players, you know? At the top, these players, they run, Turner, Bichette, Bobby Witt Jr., Francisco Lindor, you know, Dansby Swanson, they hit homers and run and hit for good averages. Like, they're really good players and they deserve to be taken pretty high.
Yeah. And I think we talked about Witt a little bit on the third base episode. When I look at him, my only real reservation is that we saw him hit .254 with a .294 OBP. Mm-hmm. Last season as a rookie. He should get better. He will almost certainly get better. Being a mid first round pick, it's already priced in, right? This is probably a guy that, without prospect hype, if that didn't exist, he'd go in the second round instead of the first. So you're not overpaying by that much. But my concern would be that maybe he doesn't take that step this year. Maybe it takes a couple of years. You just don't see a lot of guys with a sub 300 OBP become stars quickly. It does happen. I looked at a big leaderboard going back. I think I went back to 2000, and you saw some players who were under 23 that are very good players. Now, Xander Bogaerts is actually one of them. He had a .240, .297, .362 line back in 2014. It happens. A lot of guys that are on this list, though, are players that are pretty flawed. Most of them don't have tools like Bobby Witt Jr., so the comps are pretty flimsy. Anyway, my main concern is that it might not happen as quickly, the leap to being a possible 1-1 sort of player. Maybe it doesn't happen as quickly as some people would like. I can take a player at pick 8, pick 9, pick 10 that I have a lot more confidence in because they've got the multi-year track record and they also do the things that Witt does. That's it. It's not that I don't like the player. It's that I like some of the other players I can take in that spot a little bit more, and I want a little more security in the middle part of round one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely, if we're talking overall, I'm definitely taking, you know, like Kyle Tucker ahead of Bobby Witt Jr., but ADP says that's true. You know, the would you rather from Bobby Witt that you're talking about there, that you're referencing, is that Yordan Alvarez, Juan Soto, Mookie Betts, Vlad Guerrero? Those are the types of players you would take over Bobby Witt?
Yep, that's exactly right. And well, a couple of those guys don't run.
Though.
Right, a couple of those, yeah, most of those guys don't run. But it's because I know there's bags there in round two. There's bags there in round three. You don't have to get them right away. You can live with not getting your stolen bases or part
That's
of your stolen
true.
Bases
I'm a little
in round
fixated
one.
On getting a 5-2 player in the first round.
But if you see it, if you saw the growth you wanted to see over the course of Witt's rookie season, it was an amazing rookie season. If you saw it, go ahead, do it.
The distance between his zone swing and out of zone swing grew over the course of the season. His plate discipline improved over the course of the season.
Yeah, and that's exactly what should happen for a guy that's supposed to be as good as he's going to be.
And that's what you need to see. And the max EV at 113.7 is really good. It's not, it's actually close to elite. It's pretty elite. The barrel rate at 8.7 wasn't elite, but pretty good, I think, for your first season. And he had massive ISOs in isolated slugging percentages in the minors. And he was 42 to 44% better than league average in AA and AAA. So I think there's another level, and I think it's defensible, actually. I think it's defensible to take him where he is. However, I've made this mistake before where I've taken players ahead of Yordan Alvarez. And that dude is a beast. I think he's the best. I think, you know, this Aaron Judge is a very good player, but I think Yordan Alvarez is maybe the best pure hitter in baseball.
That's a big, but it's kind of, to me, it's like, why would I not, why would I pass on him?
Yeah.
Right. Again, Bobby Witt Jr. is
right
a great
now.
Player.
He could, Witt could be that, but I actually don't think Witt could ever be the best hitter in baseball. I just don't.
No,
I don't see it.
But he could be. I think he can be a 1-1 pick in fantasy.
Yes,
because he's got enough power and speed to do it.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would kind of say to skeptics, fellow skeptics like me, is that, you know, 294 OBP from a rookie is not that bad. And last year, the 254, 294, 428 slash line was a 99 WRC plus. The league context is still really important. I think this is the reverse. The Brian Reynolds problem, where Brian Reynolds is like, you look at that one, and you're like, oh, that doesn't quite make sense. This is kind of happening with Bobby Witt Jr. too, where that's fine. A league average line from a rookie, that's success by any reasonable measure. And then he does it with power and speed. So it's perfect for our game. So there's a case for him, but I think I just like other guys right in that spot instead. Maybe it's a snake draft thing too. Non-snake situation. Maybe I've got Witt and a couple of other hitters I like as my core.
Mm-hmm. And keeper leagues, he's
of course
one of the top five assets in the game. You know,
yeah.
One of the top five players in the game. The turn, after the turn, there's a little bit of controversy for me. The early shortstops in the second round, we've talked Bo Bichette to death. You know, I think he's a really good player, and there's something that he's making it. He's making the bad play discipline work for him, with a elite hit tool and a great spray charts. And so, you know, we've talked about how he started getting caught on the base pass last year, but the rules may come just in time for him to kind of go back to, he could have a 30-30 season next year. And he could go 280, 30-30. He's projected for pretty close to that. He's projected for 280, 25-15. I don't know that I want a player with his kind of play discipline when he's 33, but he's 24.
Yeah, you get some time before that's a problem.
Yeah, so I think I'm cool with him now. He's in the middle of his career. The rules might be perfect for him.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The next one is the real tough one for me. Fernando Tatis Jr. is going 17th right now. And there's just so many things about him that I'm surprised that he's going in the second round. He's still it's almost like the Jacob deGrom of hitters, you know. He's in 539 plate appearances, which I guess is doable for him. Even with the suspension and the injuries, in 539 plate appearances, the Bat X says he's going to be the most valuable shortstop, and he must be one of the most valuable players overall, the fourth most valuable player overall. So I guess if you're taking him at 17, you're actually getting 13 picks of discount on him.
Sure. Yeah, you could make that argument.
That's almost a full round discount.
That's the case for. I think that's the pro case for Tatis. I would take Witt over Tatis if I'm choosing. So just to give you an idea how far Witt would fall if he fell, if I'm in the room, I'm not going to...
Would you take Bo over Witt?
No. I think I trust Witt's speed more than I trust Bo's speed. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the scouting grades on Bo's speed have been now validated by sprint speed. Right? He's not quite a burner. He runs fine, but he's not a burner. I think Witt's a little more of a burner, and that matters as far as keeping that stolen base total consistently high. The Tatis problem, or problems, there are many of them. The PEDs, right? There's always the question, what's the player going to be when he comes back from PEDs? I've always thought that the benefits just hang on in many ways. Like, you gain strength. If you maintain that strength, well, yeah, you got popped, you lost time, you lost money, but you keep some of that strength, at least for a while. So I'm not, the PEDs, as far as the things I'm worried about, it'd be bottom of the list. The next question is the wrist. Two surgeries on the wrist, which started to seem like more of a problem than the shoulder, which I think in the eyes of most people is the bigger of the two injuries. So he's got two significant injuries. He played through the shoulder. We know he's popping the shoulder in and out. It was a labrum surgery. And something you and I were talking about before this episode is the difficulty of trying to parse out the specific nature of a player's injury. So in the case of Tatis, a labrum tear, there are a few varieties of labrum tear. There are severities, right? You could have a partial, you could have a complete. All of those things are very tough.
You know, there's like, yeah.
Yeah, very, very tough to pin down because he was playing through it before the suspension happened, right? He was going to put off the surgery, and he was able to play at this ridiculously high level. So you start to read the reports, and you try to trust the injury experts the best you can. Virginia Zakas does a great job with inside injuries. She writes up pieces for The Athletic. And Jeff Stotts does it at RotoWire. I know Jeff Zimmerman takes the data-driven approach, tries to look at the database and pull things in and figure out how much time people miss. Derek Rhodes has done this for years. So you look at the data and try and make the best possible decision based on the information we have. And I'm throwing this out there as more of a caution. The information is only as good as what teams and players share with us. And that can vary a lot from case to case, yeah. Too.
The iconic moment for me is, being in the clubhouse with Jose Altuve, and he's got to go on the IL for his knee. And we're literally asking him, what's wrong with your knee? And he's like, I can't tell you. And I don't think we ever found out. Like, he's playing now. And what was wrong with his knee? We still don't really know what was wrong with Jose Altuve's knee. And he's stealing bases and seems healthy. And like, okay, fine, I guess. But it makes it really hard. Also, John Rogale does injury analysis on Tommy John surgery. And he was, in the course of a discussion, pointing out that we don't always even know what they did in the Tommy John surgeries. Now there's this internal brace, which, you know, I think Tyler Glass now did that instead of the Tommy John. If you lump him in with Tommy John returnees and say, oh, he's got the Tommy John, like we've said this on the pitching podcast, like, oh, he's got the Tommy John honeymoon. Well, does he actually with the internal brace? And there's like this, that also points out that A, the information is not good, and B, the space is evolving, right? So we have this research that suggests there's a Tommy John honeymoon, but now there's a new Tommy John surgery, you know, and is it better or worse or what, you know? So, you know, like there's that aspect to it. So I really appreciate what Jeff Zimmerman has done, and he's got this this piece where he's looked at all the labrum tears in the past, and he's lumped them together and looked at their change and the average sort of change in WRC plus was, you know, sort of a drop of 20 points. You know, and Fernando Tatis Jr. was so good with 155 WRC plus that if he was 133 WRC plus, he'd still be great. Other hitters with a projection around there are Paul Goldschmidt and Mookie Betts and Julio Rodriguez. So like, okay.
Still a first rounder. Okay.
Yeah. Still great. However, there are so many people in this list that I just don't think are at all relevant. Like Tatis is 23 and he tried to keep it, to some relevant ages, but Pablo Sandoval is 29. Devin Masaraco is 28. Derek Barton's surgery was in 2011. Jesus Flores's was in 2009. Like, I think maybe the surgery has come someplace since then. The closest, and then there's the aspect of when you do analysis like this, do you actually know the true talent of the player before or after? You know, like, he has Jake Meyers on here. And so Jake Meyers had surgery to repair that labrum. He had a 109 WRC plus before and a 65 after. That looks really bad, and that affects the data set a lot. However, was Jake Meyers ever a true talent 109 WRC plus? Like, do we know that that's how good he was?
Right. And, we don't know that that's the case.
Right, and that 65 after, how much was bad luck there? You know, so... one of the guys that that stuck out for me was Justin Upton. Yes, the surgery was in 2009, but he was 22, and Fernando Tatis Jr. is 23, and Upton went on to have a great career afterwards, and he didn't really see that much of a drop in his – he didn't see a drop at all in his WRC+. I think that's a nice comp for me. That's a similar type of player in terms of athleticism, age, you know. And I think going forward, Tatis might be an outfielder. So I think that's a good comp. However, I think there are some limits to doing this database. And we've been pointing it out about the quality of information, the changes in the actual science underneath, and finding the right comps. There's another guy I'd like to point out. Jesse Morse does some good stuff on Twitter. That's like kind of the doctor approach where they look more at the general population. But how much does the general population how different is the athletic, group from the general population, right? Like, if I had the surgery, it would take me, I would never, it would take me forever, but yeah. Tatis is 22 and an athlete. So what I like about Virginia Zakas and the inside injuries approach is it seems to be both the data and the science. And I think this passage was actually maybe the most damning for me and maybe the reason I'm out. And it has nothing to do with the shoulder. You alluded to this, but... Tatis, this is from Virginia Zakas' article on The Athletic, January 25th, and it says here, Tatis' wrist injury was a scaphoid bone fracture. It is a very tough injury to recover from, as this bone receives poor blood supply and it doesn't heal well. During the first procedure, multiple screws were inserted to stabilize the break, but another procedure was needed in October. This time, the procedure involved one central screw replacing multiple screws. While it isn't surprising, it is concerning that Tatis' wrist required a second surgery. This one will take longer to heal. The timeline to recover from the shoulder and wrist surgeries will be fairly close, but the wrist is more likely to have long-term injuries. And she says, I would stay away from drafting him.
Right. And it comes back to an elevated price. Yeah, even if he's projected to be a top five player by raw value, and you can get him at pick 15 or even pick 20, there's a massive amount of risk. I think comparing him to the position player equivalent of DeGrom is fair. I think you can just walk away at this stage from any player. If for any reason, there's no, you don't have to draft anyone in this range just because
you don't want the spreadsheet tells you to. First pick, right? Or your second pick?
I think if you do, you have to be a lot more conservative with other things because you can't afford, if the $40 player you drafted is not around and you get $5 worth of value, that's a pretty big hit to your roster.
Yeah. Although it may actually be part of a YOLO situation where, you know, if that's the risk, then you want some $5 guys that could be $40 guys. So just build a, you know, you never know roster. People call this the like going for the overall, because in the NFBC there's like an overall prize, and I see some aspect to that makes sense, because you know the NFBC takes a fairly big rake in terms of what the money you put in and money you can win, at least in your local league, and part of that rake is to, you know, to put to the overall, which is a big prize of, you know, hundreds of, you know, 100,000. I should know this specifically, but it's a big number. And then they also do a lot of lobbying, and there's a lot of back end work, and you know, it makes sense that they need money to operate. But you know, it also means that when you're building a team, you have this dual thing of like, you know, do I try to win my local league or try to win overall? And you could have this sort of YOLO, you only live once, like I'm going for the overall prize where I take Tatis and DeGrom and blah, 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 blah. But I think, you know, you have to think about sort of return on investment. And like, if you took that strategy a bunch of times, you could just basically lose all your leagues and lose all your money, right? All your entry fees and all that. So I take a sort of in-between approach where I want to try and win my league because I want a good return on my investment. I want to end the year with more money than I started, you know?
Yeah, that's a lot of people play that way.
I'll take some shots late, and like that's why, like in my main event, like I took Julio Rodriguez late last year because I was like, you know, if I am going to win this league, there's something's got to go kind of right. There's got to be some kind of Hail Mary-ish aspect to this, but I just don't want to make the whole roster a Hail Mary. I don't think I could handle leaning in and taking Tatis and DeGrom. You could actually do that, couldn't you?
Yo, you could double tap with that. That's usually there for you at the end. I'm intrigued by it. I'm not bankrolled in a way where I can go to the main event and say, here's $1,750. I don't care if this breaks. But I don't know if you have to crank the injury risk dial for the entire draft all the way to the max. I think right. If you take those two guys, you could say, oh, great. I may have got literally the two best players in the pool. It's possible on a per game basis. I got the two best. And if they play 90% of the games they're supposed to play and I do well with everything else, I'm fine. You don't have to go with that and say, I'm going to draft all these guys that have spent extensive time on the IL the last 3 years. You could actually like build a very solid core behind them. And I think that's fine too. It's risky, but it's not as risky as like every possible risky decision you could make. I don't think you have to go all in to get the benefits of the risk reward probabilities with those two players.
Yeah, the good news is shortstop's pretty deep. And a nice thing about this episode from a sausage making perspective is you don't really have to have the depth charts open.
No, you kind of just know.
These are the shortstops or they're not. I mean, it really, you have to get down to like maybe Tyro Estrada and Luis Urias around 20 by the auction calculator before you're really worried about any sort of depth chart issues. But you know, I think the next crew is fine. I do actually wonder a little bit about Dansby Swanson because, he was very much my least favorite shortstop of the shortstops that were available this year. And I just worry that, you know, the 348 BABIP, the age 27 season, the big season right before his best season by WRC plus right before signing a big deal, the most stolen bases he's ever had. Like there's just too many career highs, like his career high OBP, you know, like, or second best OBP. Like, I just, there's too many career highs. Like, I just feel like he's going to step back.
That's very reasonable. New environment, supporting cast not being as good also changes the floor quite a bit for Dansby Swanson. It's interesting that by projection, Francisco Lindor is supposed to be in this tier. By ADP, he is not. He goes 20 to 30 picks earlier than the beginning of this group. I'm wondering what you're doing. If you're sitting in the late part of round one where you're at the 2-3 turn and Lindor is there, are you passing because of the way the projections play out compared to the likes of Seager and O'Neal Cruz and Tommy Edman and Wander and Swanson?
I think that Lindor's a better hitter than Swanson. Why is that not bearing out?
I've wondered this too with his projections. I don't really understand why they're as light as they are. I think it's got something to do probably with the speed not being in the 20 range anymore. It's like 13 to 14 steals across the board, and that's with a pretty heavy volume of playing time.
They're all projecting him for a 275 BABIP. Career 294 BABIP, 301 last year, but he had a real run there between 2017 and 2021 where he had low BABIPs. It's not because of fly balls.
It's a 294 career BABIP. Wouldn't you project that for him, though? Why would it be 275? Why wouldn't it just be his career number?
Is it the shift? He's a switch hitter.
I don't know. Something seems a little off.
Let me see. I'm just going to do a raw thing here real quick of how often he was shifted. See if I can... Yeah. Yeah. He's generally was shifted more often as his career went on. And last year he was shifted the most he's ever was shifted.
And that will be less problematic for him this year.
I'm taking the over on the projections, man. I know, Lindor, you're right. Lindor in the auction calculator for the bat is $19 projection. Swanson is a $17 projection. But in my head, I've got Lindor is more as a $20 player. And $20 players can go in the second round. Although, Corey Seager, who will also benefit even more from the shift, but does not steal, is projected to be more valuable than Francisco Lindor and should get a lot of the same benefit from the other stuff. So maybe Lindor is a bad value draft, huh?
Yeah, I think he's fine. I actually think there are a few more questions about this second tier that Lindor doesn't have. I mean, O'Neal Cruz. Don't want to talk about fun players that have a wide range of outcomes.
Is he really going that high?
Yeah. People love O'Neal Cruz.
Where is he?
66. Pick 66. The seventh shortstop off the board.
Well, I'm glad Seager goes 58, and I would take him over O'Neal Cruz. And I was a guy that took a lot of O'Neal Cruz, and he definitely has. He was on that article from Ben Clemens in terms of guys that have great raw power and could unlock it. And the problem is, I love that article, and I'm drafting off that article, but I'm drafting late off that article.
After pick 200, sure.
Jesus Sanchez off that article. I'm not drafting O'Neal Cruz at 66 off that article, you know? So I think the fact that O'Neal Cruz struck out 50% of the time against lefties last year, and it was 50% of the time in every month. Thanks to shout out to Jeff Zimmerman for that pull. But that is a real eye opener for me. I just think that's he's really scraping the top of acceptable strikeout rates for me. So Corey Seager is much safer for me. And he's definitely, no matter how you slice it, he's going to benefit from the shift rules.
Right. I think the only drawback with Corey Seager is that usually you're getting some stolen bases from middle infield spots. So not get them from a middle infield spot specifically just means you got to make sure you get a few extra bags somewhere else. Not the end of the world.
It is a thing. But that is a big gap for Seager being projected to be better than Francisco Lindor and going 62 and Lindor going 29 is a huge gap. And what's also funny about it is no shortstops go in between. That's just going to change over time. Seager's going to go up, 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 up.
I don't know. I think that's where everyone's drafting pitchers in that cushion between Lindor and Seager.
Pitchers in between, yeah.
I think it's more like, oh, we can wait on Corey Seager. And that's just the consensus opinion. Yeah, I can wait. And it's, so far, it's working. Maybe there will be some rooms where he gets jumped up a little bit. But I think everyone's chasing something else. Or they're chasing bags. If they're not getting a pitcher in that spot, they're looking for steals, or looking for saves, or looking for starting pitchers instead of a great shortstop that doesn't run.
Well, there is a opportunity there to maybe go and also not take a reliever in the top four. That's an easy way to get Seager, right? Go bat, arm, bat, or bat. I guess you could go bat, arm, Seager. But the fourth is where you need to take Seager if you want to jump him and make sure you get him. And it would still be a value pick in the fourth round.
I would rather, if I'm going to have that build, I'd rather have two other bats that run. And I might, it really depends on who the pitcher is.
So you go
whether it's a starter or a reliever.
Bat, arm, bat, Seager. So you'd be three bats out of four then.
Yeah, it'd either be bat, arm, bat, Seager, or bat, arm, Seager.
Yeah.
But you need some steals.
But that means no closer. Unless you're an insane person. And you go closer and three bats before you take your first starting pitcher.
That's not insane. I could do that.
Yeah, I guess so. It seems insane to me.
There's so many ways to play. Like, come on.
That's true. You could hit the high-end number twos pretty hard after that.
Yeah. We had a whole bunch of pitchers we liked in that pick 100 to 150 range. If you like those guys, you believe in them, you can get three from that range and hold off on pitching early, or get one pitcher early, and then go to town.
Arm after Seager. Well, I do think that's, you're right, that's why Seager is where he is. And then, you know, Seager unlocks a little run of shortstops by ADP, where it's O'Neill Cruz, Tommy Edman, Dansby Swanson, and then Wander Franco and Xander Bogaerts, they all go before 85. So that's, you know, like four or five in the next 20. The auction calculator says you should be taking of that group, Swanson, I guess. The auction calculator does not like Edmund where he's going. Does not really like Cruz where he's going.
I'm with the calculator on this one. I'm becoming the person who is very boring with the players I draft early. O'Neill Cruz is fun, therefore DVR does not want him on his roster in 2023.
You're a no fun guy.
I'm a no fun guy in the first six or seven rounds, usually.
Yeah, so, you know, actually Swanson, as much as I talk crap on him, this is how the Cubs ended up with him, where it's like, we didn't spend $300 million. You know, like, Swanson's okay where he's going. I guess he's okay where he's going. You know, he's fine where he's going. There is a name that I did not say that the auction calculator likes better than all the names I did say, except for Swanson. Willie Adames, man.
Yeah.
Willie Adames is, by the auction calculator, a $16 player and is worth more than Tim Anderson, Xander Bogaerts, Tommy Edman, Carlos Correa, O'Neill Cruz, and Wander Franco, all guys who go ahead of him.
Well, we've got a full two-year run now where we've seen that the power is more like 30 home run power. And that came even in a season with the deadened ball last year. The biggest concerns with Willie Adames would be that the batting average has never really been great over a full season. So he's just sort of been okay. And last year it was bad at .238. But for a guy that had a 13% barrel rate, that seems pretty, pretty
low. First year his BABIP was below .320. That seems relevant.
Yeah. So the odds of Willie Adames, if everything else was the same, the odds of him hitting .238 again, they're not great. He's probably going to hit .250, .260 again. But there's room for a little more, and he runs a little bit. I don't really see much of a difference between Willie Adames and Dansby Swanson, and I would probably look at the Parks and say I'd rather have Adames. Like, I can feel more confident in Adames' power than I can in Swanson's power right now.
100%. The leg thing is interesting, but Swanson's coming off a career high. Even with the new rules, I could see him settling back down to 12 to 15, you know? I think people really do steal more bases in contract years. That's something that someone should study, because Aaron Judge, you know, stole so many more bases than he normally does, you know? And I think they're just like, I want every part of my package to look good when I'm you know, when my agent is trying to sell me. So,
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Is there anyone you're avoiding from this back cluster? If we're both sort of out on cruise around that pick 65, 70 range, not because he can't be good, but because he's got a lot of flaws he's going to have to work through. Edmund's a guy we're passing on. Swanson seems like a guy we're passing on. We like Adames. Wander, Bogarts, Tim Anderson, they all seem pretty solid where they're going. I actually think I like Bogarts even more than Swanson. I think Bogarts is slightly underdrafted right now. Batting average could actually be a great category for him. Run production. Power might be waning a little bit, but those counting stats should be really good too.
Yeah. There is a weird thing where, like, in Boston, the Green Monster turns homers into doubles. But it also turns flyouts into doubles. So there's this kind of like homer suppression, but batting average inflation that happens in Boston. And you just wonder how much, you know, like when people talk about like Adalberto Mondesi playing in Boston, like people were talking about like, oh, he needs to learn to use the wall. So it really looks like Bogarts, in a way, learned to use the wall. And will he unlearn that? You know, will he go back to trying to be more of a power hitter? You know, last year was the highest ground ball rate he'd had in the last 5 years. Is that an aging thing? Was that a thing he did on purpose? So definitely some questions, I think, about what he will look like. So I'm not actually that in on him. And you know, there's always like a use case where it would make sense for my team. You know, I think the batting average projection on him is a little bit light for a guy that seems to have an elite hit tool to hit 260, 269. I think he can hit 280 or better. So I think he's a guy where you're like, oh, my batting average wasn't great and my top few picks, and he could help my batting average. I think that's where I would take him. And he actually goes right next to a guy that I have a similar use case. It's a different use case, but Tim Anderson is not my favorite type of player in terms of the way he is, the way his plate discipline is. I love his game. I love his excitement. I love his athleticism. But in terms of like a collection of statistics, it's not my favorite type of player in terms of not great plate discipline, not great power, not like sort of 30, 40 stolen base type history in there. But I have found myself taking Tim Anderson if I feel I'm light on stolen bases. So I think the Tim Anderson, Xander Bogarts decision is fascinating because I can find flaws in both. And I would love to maybe avoid them, but I found myself having to draft one or the other for different builds. Because I do think there's a little bit of a drop off after them. You know, after them on the auction calculator, you're talking about Tommy Edmund, who I don't really want, Carlos Correa, who doesn't steal and has a bit, you know, a big injury risk, you know, that we didn't even really know about as bad as it was. O'Neill Cruz, who's a batting average risk and a strikeout risk. And I think I'd want to go down to sort of Wander Franco. I'd want to wait, I think, if I didn't take in Tim Anderson. So Tim Anderson's the last one I sort of want at ADP. The rest I kind of want to wait on. Because if I'm going to take Wander Franco where he's going, he's just projected so close to Amed Rosario and Jeremy Pena that I could just lump those three together and take them. And I think their output will actually be similar. I could just take whichever one of the three fell instead of paying a lot for Wander Franco. Maybe I'm wrong. Wander definitely has the most upside of the group. Do you see enough to pay the price for Wander Franco?
I'd still rather, I mean, look, if you're trying to swing for the fences at shortstop and O'Neill Cruz is going around pick 65 and Wander goes 10, 15 picks later, similar range, I'm taking Wander.
Yeah, I mean, at least he makes a ton of contact.
Makes a ton of contact. I know we haven't seen the in-game power yet. It's 13 homers over 153 games in the big league, so almost a full season. 13-10 for a guy that hasn't turned 22 yet. He turns 22 in
good
March.
Good raw power, though. Good max EV.
Good raw, and so good with the hit tool that it seems impossible that he won't begin to unlock more of that power. And I just like that he ran a little bit last year, too. That was a bit of an unknown. So you give him 10, 12 bags, potentially, on top of being an asset and average. No days off so long as he's healthy. The power, if it's 15 homer power, you're okay with that in this range. He could probably get you more. I think get you a lot more, but I think you'll have to get a little more to be really happy with where he's going right now. So I'm in at the price. I think it still makes sense, and it's rare to get a player who is projected as highly as Wander has been as an extremely young player. It's rare to be able to get that player after pick 75 in redraft as he enters his third year.
He's going over Xander and Tim Anderson right now.
Probably taking him over Anderson, not Xander. Part of my belief in Bogaerts, I know for a right-handed hitter, Petco's not as bad as it is for a lefty from a power perspective. It's changed for a few years, so that's part of it. Bogaerts has had that wrist injury, too, that has sapped some of his power in recent years. If that wrist is healthy, I think that power can bounce back and be low to mid-20s home run power pretty easily. So I think I'll take Bogaerts over Wander for this year. Because of Anderson, a lot of absences over the years, you know, just tends to get dinged up quite a bit. I'd take Wander over Tim Anderson, but I would take Bogaerts over Wander for this year only.
Yeah, I think it's important not to be just a total absolutist when it comes to the auction calculator or the numbers. You know, Tim Anderson, $2 more projection than Wander Franco. But if you know, looking at these sort of 80th percentile and 20th percentile projections has really opened my eyes to the shape of these projections. You know, that's spitting out Tim Anderson as a $16 median player with 589 plate appearances. You know, if he's lighter than those 589 plate appearances, that's a way he can be worth less than Franco. And then Franco's 80th percentile projection is going to be way better than Tim Anderson's 80th percentile projection.
Yeah.
So the sort of error bands about these projections are meaningful as well. So if you see them as being basically both $15 players, then you should take Wander Franco.
Yeah, that's a great summary. That is pretty much how I see it right now with those two players. Let's go to the third tier, small third tier. Jeremy Peña, Carlos Correa, Amed Rosario, Nico Horner. Not a bad group of players. If you missed in tier two and weren't positioned in tier one to get someone, I think you could live to tell the tale of a team that did really well with really, I don't know, maybe any of these guys. I think I'm a lot more confident in Peña and Correa. I think Rosario last year may have been that career year we were hoping for from Amed Rosario. That's very likely to me. But he's not overpriced. I think he's fairly priced where he's going. I think of this group, Nico Horner's the guy that I'm the least sure about because I think he's another one of those players that has a richer injury history than you realize. And if you pair that with some skills that have kind of all shown up at once, you wonder, like, is he gonna fall back a little bit from a power perspective? Is the stolen base volume from last year reliable? How does he continue forward and continue growing on this profile? Is there another level for Nico Horner? I think it's, to me, something I'm just not sure about.
Yeah, I think there is. I think you're right. The auction calculator says they're basically similar players, except has Horner as a $9 player, Rosario is a $12 player. So that's a bigger gap, but it's a little bit like the Wander Franco situation where I think Amed Rosario is a very safe $12, and Nico Horner is a guy who could return $15 value or $5 value. And it's a little bit tough to figure out which one, but I like that he got to the 517 plate appearances last year. I like silly things like he has a no-look homer, BP homer on social media right now. I just like that because I think there is another level, but I don't really, every once in a while you run into somebody where you don't really have statistical evidence for it. Like his
Max EV.
Yeah, I just like it. The Max EV was a 109.7. I would just say, you know, 108 is about average. So that's pretty mediocre raw power. The bail rate is awful. There's nothing really to point to other than I just love the contact, and I think he's going to grow into more kind of doubles and homers output in the future.
Yeah, I just think it puts a ton of pressure on the speed. He was so efficient, it's totally possible that he can repeat the 20 steal season from a year ago, but when the barrel rate is that low, that category can't dip. And I wonder if the counting stats are also going to lag a little bit too. I do like some of the additions the Cubs have made, so maybe we'll see a little bit of a bump from Nico Horner in that runs column and that RBI column this season. I think Jeremy Peña is really interesting too, because the season in 2022 was very solid. 253 average, 22 homers, 11 steals, good counting stats, and he was hurt. There's a clear drop-off from his first injury, like the production pre-injury and what he did after. I think we saw him start to get healthy again late in the year, played really well in the playoffs as well. I don't know how long you're going to be able to get Jeremy Peña clearly behind that ADP tier two group, but I really like taking advantage of that. He's kind of the perfect MI sort of player for me. If I've already got one of the guys from the first two tiers, I'm very happy to take Peña around that pick 100 range.
Yeah, the only thing that's weird for me is that he definitely chased more as the season went on. He definitely seemed to have a hole low and away. You know, he has a bit of a propensity to swing over the top of sliders. And I have a little bit of PTSD from late career Andrew Jones, watching him in Atlanta and after, of how that can play out. But maybe it's another concern that I shouldn't worry about so much when he's young. You know, like when he's young and spry, he's going to make enough contact on those and enough powerful contact on those to keep hit pitchers honest. And it won't be as much of a problem until he's older and just can't make contact like Andrew Jones did at the end of his career. I don't know. There is a little whiff of risk around Peña that is represented by his walk rate, his chase rate, and that hole opening up, his chase rate going up as the season went on. That I think is, I guess, baked in now, you know? I think that is baked into the price now, but if people start hyping him, I'm worried that he could kind of outgrow his draft cost. I'm okay at 105 right now, or, you know, low hundreds. I'm okay with taking him ahead of Correa. You know, I would take Adames, of course, over him as the draft position does. But if he goes ahead of Adames, or if he starts getting into the Tim Anderson late 80s or something, I may not end up with Peña.
Yeah, I think you're probably looking at a guy that has a similar line to Willie Adames when the season is over, with less power. I think that's, to me, the biggest difference. Like, why is Peña behind that group right now? But I can live with that, because I think those counting stats are going to be really good with him being the everyday shortstop in Houston again. Carlos Correa returning to Minnesota. We've seen it for a year, so we kind of get a feel for how he fits into that ballpark. It's a lot like the Corey Seager problem, a shortstop that doesn't run. I think you see Correa get dinged a lot more because of the extent of his injuries, but last year did get up to 590 plate appearances. It gives him 1,230 over the last two seasons combined. If you kind of take away everything before that, you could feel a lot better about Correa's durability. So how much do the longer-term injuries worry you with Correa as you try and forecast out his volume for playing time this year? Because if you think he can get to 590 again, he's probably underpriced by two rounds right now.
It's true. And the auction calculator loves him because they've got him at 620 plate appearances, which he's done twice in his career. I tend to think that there's a powerful narrative here that we just underwent this offseason that should be telling us that there's more injury risk here than at first appeared.
Yes. I think the question has been, though, how much of that is year 5, 6, 7 of the long-term deal, and how much of that was 2023? Like, I think a lot of that was far the deal in the he future.
Because the deal he did end up getting, he did get a lot of money in the short term. So they, you know, definitely did seem to be a disagreement about, you know, should we give him a 13-year deal or a 6-year deal?
I'm in for this year. I'm fine. I have no issue with it.
I like the skills. And the only difficulty, I think he seems like a Corey Seager light, you know, a Corey, you know, and the only difficulty is, you know, making sure you get steals somewhere else.
I think he can do, I think Correa can do every single thing that we want Corey Seager to do. I think he can do all of it. It's just going to come down to health. And I think Seager had that hip surgery a few years ago, hasn't had the same types of chronic things. Mm-hmm. It's been a slightly shorter list of ailments, I would say, for Seager. But yeah, this me stands out as a
little
great
bit of a
value
righty
player.
Versus lefty thing too, where Seager is the lefty and might benefit more from the shift rules. But there's a lot of similarities in terms of raw power, barrels, you know, disciplined contact. You know, just a guy who's likely to hit for a high batting average with power.
Yeah, and I think Amed Rosario, just to bring him up for a minute, he is okay where he's going. I think he's a good kind of a life raft if you're short on speed in the middle infield. I think he can help you there. Batting average floor is pretty high. I am always skeptical of the power. Kind of has the Nico Horner-ish low barrel rates, a little higher than Horner, 4.5% last year. But it's hard to bank on that. So much depends on his legs.
I think you're right.
As far as
his
value goes,
he's maxed out a little bit.
Yeah, there's nothing else there to tack on.
Maybe some steals with the new rules, but I wouldn't. Yeah, I think he's reached his apex.
The weirdest cluster of players we've talked about in this entire series is this fourth ADP tier of shortstops.
I do not want any part, I think, of actually, I don't want any part of any of this.
No, I don't think I want to draft any of these players. Tyro Estrada, Javier Baez, Adalberto Mondesi, Bryson Stott, Jorge Mateo. Playing time is actually a problem for everyone except for Baez.
This is where you actually have to get the depth charts out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I could see Tyro Estrada coming close to another everyday role just because the Giants didn't get a whale to put in the infield to eat up all the playing time. So, okay, like, and by whale, I mean Carlos Correa or a player like that.
Right, but
they got
one
of the big shortstops. It breaks everything down.
Crawford is coming back, and they have other players at second and third where Tyro would play. So there's an easy narrative where Tyro doesn't play necessarily every day and gets to like 500 plate appearances, but gets there in a way that's really annoying to people who are in weekly leagues.
Right. He to me, he's like Amed Rosario with playing time downside risk.
Yeah. Like, I'm not into it. Javi Baez, you know, there has been a little bit of a resurgence of people backing him because his price has fallen so low and he still hits homers and steals bases. I think if I was forced to shop in this tier, I would take Javi Baez.
You mentioned the end of Andrew Jones's career, I think, a little earlier in this episode. And I remember, I think it was my first year in Tout Wars, I traded for Andrew Jones, and it was a bad Andrew Jones year.
Was that like Dodgers Andrew Jones or something?
I think it was Dodgers Andrew Jones. Horrible decision. Early season trade. He was hurt. He was a total mess. I think the problem with Javier Baez has been well documented throughout his career. The free-swinging approach that enables him to unlock incredible raw power, it works against him. And the older you get, the more that works against you. Now, I think the true downside here is if you're in a league like AL Labor, and there's not many leagues out there like this anymore, but if you're in a league where you draft him and he has to stay in your lineup or be cut unless he gets hurt,
and there is no replacement,
he could do amazing damage to you. Like that is in his range of outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, he could have a season where he hits 188 with like 15 homers.
Right, and they're not going to sit him. I mean, it's year two of a six-year, $140 million contract. He's playing. He's going to play every day. So that's the good news. If you need playing time, Baez is going to play. And the good news is most leagues don't have the AL labor rule where you have to leave him in your lineup. You can cut him. You can make that decision.
Year.
Underneath, you still see an 8% barrel rate. It was a big drop from where he was. I think there's something
drop in raw power.
I think if you said you got to draft one guy from this group, it's Baez. Yeah. It's actually not that close for me.
Yeah, it's the only one that leaps off the page is, okay, like I'll hold my nose and do it. I don't want any of the other ones really. I think Stott has some secret playing time risk with Josh Harrison because in town.
Yeah, Harrison. Yeah, we talked about that addition a little earlier in the week. So I think some of the appeal of Stott has faded. Mateo, as they keep adding more and more young infielders, more young players to that depth chart, his playing time keeps going down. It's the same kind of problem that Tyro Estrada has, except there's prospect pressure coming.
Yeah, Jordan Westberg.
Norby, Connor Norby, I think could be part of the mix in the infield eventually.
And like couldn't Gunner play short? Like he was a
yeah, Gunner can play short and third.
Like till last year. Jordan Westberg is knocking on the door, dude. I didn't even actually realize how close he was. He's had a 129 WRC plus in AAA last year and a 122 in AA last year. He's actually a pretty good draft and hold pickup, I think. He's going to play in the big leagues this year.
Yeah, Westberg and Joey Ortiz both look like they're ready to play in the big leagues. So they have plenty of infield depth, and that is not a good thing for Jorge Mateo.
No, because he's not a good player.
But he could end up on a new rebuilding team.
Way better than I am, and he's like super athletic and like
super toolsy, you know, good defensive shortstop.
He almost had 3 wins in the big leagues last year. That's rude of me to be like that, but it's not at all the type of player I would try to build around, and I don't think that the Orioles are either. It seems to me like a future utility guy or a guy that you move to center, you know, or, you know, but they don't need that. But like you moved him to second, you know, just move him further and further away from the core of the team until he's just like your utility guy on a good team, you know?
If I had to build the Marlins roster for this season, I'd rather have Jorge Mateo at shortstop than Joey Wendell.
And that ends up being a thing that happens. You know, the Baltimore Orioles are open for business, and I think he's an easy guy that they could trade away. So that would be a good news for Mateo in terms of playing time, but I don't want to bet on anything like that. I think the bet here is on the under on his projected. Well, actually, it's already baked in. If you're using the auction calculator, you're not going to end up with Jorge Mateo because right now he's already at 300 plate appearances in the Bat X.
He's below the fold. It gives you 30 players by default. You got to go to 50 on ATC to see him.
Yeah, so I do have some names, I think, that come out of the auction calculator that I'd like better than this group. I would take Javi Baez is one, I think, that, okay, let's take him from this group. In the next group, the two names that I've got circled are Ezequiel Tovar and Luis Urias. Urias is actually, I think, an ideal MI in a lot of cases, but maybe just across the board ideal MI. And here's my case for him. Decent barrel rate, decent max EV, decent strikeout rate, decent walk rate, decent defense. One of the better projections on the Brewers, so he's going to play. And then his eligibilities are super useful no matter what. Like, yes, in draft and hold, very useful. But even in like a regular situation, it's very useful to have an MICI. You know, he's going to be second, third, and short eligible. That's just super useful. If you have that guy at MI and your shortstop gets hurt, boom, you have a replacement shortstop and you can go shopping in the MI pool instead of the shortstop pool, you know? And if you have an injury to your CI, he can move him over to CI. And he has that kind of average fantasy profile where he's not going to hurt you in any category. You know what I mean? Like he's basically going to be the average fantasy player. He's going to hit 260 with 20 homers and 8 steals. You know, like that's kind of my projection in my head for him. He's going to benefit from the saves, the steals rules because he's right at that cusp of go, no go, where he's got some speed, but not enough to go a lot. And I think he's going to go more this year. So that's my case for Luis Urias. And I don't think I have to make it to you.
No, I just think the versatility alone, he makes a lot of sense there. So if you didn't draft him to fill another need, the MI situation is absolutely perfect. Goes outside that ADP tier 4 group for some reason that I can't quite figure out. But this last group is where you do throw the darts, right? Yeah, Tovar, who you mentioned. CJ Abrams, I think.
I'd rather throw the dart at Tovar over Abrams for a lot of reasons.
Tovar has shown more evidence of power, right? Is that where you're looking at that? And
plus a really nice use case, at least where you can be like, at least I use them at home. You know, it's just going to paper over a lot of issues.
The thing about C.J. Abrams that I think is easy to overlook is he, because of injuries in the minor leagues, did not play a lot in the minor leagues and is still, he's at least holding his own. Yeah. He's not a 50 WRC plus guy in the big leagues. He's very young.
How many walks did he have one last year? One? Five.
Yeah, not many. He doesn't walk a lot. But if you're throwing darts for cheap speed, I can see it. If you're speed desperate,
and
you want to take someone that can help you.
Play them all year because they want to be like, look what we got in our trade. We're not idiots.
Right. And I think if you need some evidence of a player that has the low barrel rate and did well for us last year, Nico Horner, right? Like if Abrams' power doesn't show up in 2023,
but he does not have the same hit tool as Nico Horner.
Doesn't have that hit tool, but does put a lot of balls in play. I don't know. Like I'm still intrigued by Abrams. I think you're right. Tovar's situation is better with Coors Field and a little more pop that he's shown. What do you do with the Yankees' young shortstops?
I had a bit of an eye-opening thing. I'm writing another 80-20 piece where I'm looking at 80th and 20th percentiles and zips. And I had this amazing look into zips where the 80th percentile for Anthony Volpe is a 4-win player, but the 20th percentile was a 2-win player. And that 20th percentile projection was better than Oswald Cabrera and Oswaldo Peraza's regular projections. So the floor projection for Volpe was better than the regular projection for the other two guys. So I do think I have heard some in the scouting community are questioning Anthony Volpe. You know, there, I would love to see his like barrel rates and EVs and stuff, but and they don't seem to be just awarding him shortstop, you know, when they needed to in the past. So, and then I guess a 99 plate appearance AAA stint that was no good, a softening of the WRC plus as he's advanced in the minors. I guess there's some questioning around Volpe, but Volpe's the one I want out of all of them. And this is the team that played Derek Jeter at short forever. I think they're headed towards Volpe at short.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that can go right for Volpe. I mean, if we like Tovar because he's shown some evidence of power, we've at least seen that from Volpe. We've seen patience. We've seen high walk rates in the upper levels of the minors. He's played at AAA. I think the hardest thing to figure out right now is how long do you have to wait? If he doesn't earn the opening day job between now and then, do you wait a month? Do you wait two? Can you afford to stash him? You have to draft him thinking he's a stash. He goes late enough where you can justify it, but you'd usually get one, as we like to say, especially in NFBC situations where there's no IL and you've got 7 bench spots. You can't have that many players who aren't contributing. But I think the possibilities, the ways he could end up making up that value, there are enough of those ways for this to work. He's the guy that I want, even if they go with Cabrera first.
Yeah, and I could see there's a little whiff of like the Julio Rodriguez like situation could happen, where if he's playing a lot, if he's playing with the starters in spring, and he's playing a lot, and they haven't necessarily started talking, because there was that moment where right before they started talking about, oh, Julio might make the opening day roster, even before that, there was like just this one moment of opportunity where you could just be like, wait, they're playing Julio Rodriguez all the time. They're playing him with the starters. He's gonna stay with the team. So I think if Volpe is playing shortstop a lot in spring over the other guys, I think read the tea leaves. So he gets more interesting to me the more he plays in spring training.
Any other late darts at this position? If you're in draft and hold, you can afford to wait on some guys that might not debut right away. So I've seen Ellie De La Cruz go really, really late just in case he's up for, you know,
but
August
and
September.
Nolasco Marte has to be ahead of him. I don't understand that. Maybe Marte's already off of shortstop, so, you know, he's going to come up for third. But Nolasco Marte's ahead of him in terms of minor league progression. So I don't know how that's going to go.
that much more likely that Ellie De La Cruz plays in the big leagues this year than Jordan Lawler, if you're thinking about your NL only, draft and hold, the what could go right sorts of things?
I would say that Lawler is more likely, because that team really needs a shortstop and is closer to competition than the Reds. So I think Lawler's more likely. I think Ellie is a bit of a long shot one. I'd rather have Volpe or Lawler if I'm talking about prospects. Among players that are going to play in the big leagues that I like, that are definitely going to play in the big leagues that I like in this area, I think Ha-Seong Kim is interesting. You know, there's enough of a growth pattern there. He's 27. I could see a peak year where he hits like 260 and... like, honestly, there's a whiff of, like, you know, could he go 260, 2020? That's got to be, like, within the range of outcomes. He's projected for, like, 240, 1210. Well, we've got the steel rules, you know, and they may just give him shortstop, you know? And what would that do for a young player who's gotten better every year he's been in the big leagues and has gotten used to it? What would it do to be given shortstop with Tatis on the same team, you know, and just be like, all right, man, this is my year. So I like him a little bit. It's a little bit of a feel thing, like with Nico Horner, but I just really like, there is skills growth. You know what I mean? Like, you just see he got better. Like, they gave him more playing time. He got used to the league. He struck out less. He walked more, you know, didn't necessarily hit for more power, but accrued more power numbers and just looked like a real solid player. I mean, the 3.7 wins, like a 4-win player, that's all-star level. So I'm taking Kim in that last grouping.
There's one more name I wanted to bring up because we didn't talk about him in all of the Mondesi chatter earlier in the week, but the Royals have a guy, Michael Garcia, that could end up playing a lot more as a result of Mondesi's departure. I realize Mondesi being hurt as often as he's been hasn't chewed up that much playing time, but when you look at what the Royals have right now, Garcia can actually play shortstop by all accounts. They can use Witt at third if they want to and play Garcia at short, play Massey at second, and make Nicky Lopez the super utility guy. The depth chart I look at right now basically has one of Nicky Lopez or Hunter Dozier playing a lot. And it also has some guys in the outfield that could play less at the expense of MJ Melendez, who RotoWire has as the primary DH. So I just think there's enough flexibility or enough opportunity in the Royals depth chart where Garcia could actually emerge to be a really nice endgame pick if he's going to break camp with the team. He spent some time at AAA last year, hit 274, 341, 463 was the line.
Yeah, but that's the first time he slugged like that. I don't really believe it. I see a below-average major league bat here. I see no power.
Speed, though. 39 steals between the two levels. Only caught 8 times.
Yeah. This is like, I just feel like Nicky Lopez again.
The right-handed Nicky Lopez.
Yeah, which is, that makes it worse. The other name that I want to bring up, and this is kind of a deep league thing, is JP Crawford in draft and holds and in mono leagues, I think, is one of these just perfectly acceptable players that will get, I think, another 600 plate appearances this year, may steal a little bit more with the new rules, and has enough raw power where there could be a year where he hits 12 homers. So, you know, the main thing is, like, in a draft and hold, this is a bench shortstop that will play. You can't back up your starters in draft and hold with prospects. You know, there has to be a one who will play. And in my draft and hold that I'm in the middle of, you know, my backups at first are like G-Man Choi, at second Adam Frazier. At short, J.P. Crawford, you know, he's my third because I've got Urias. But those are the types of players I like taking in draft and holds. They're veterans that are going to play, and I can plug them in. And there's some reason to like them. G-Man Choi, you know, hits into the shift a ton, and the shift rules are changing. Adam Frazier hits into the shift a ton, and the shift rules are changing. J.P. Crawford is just a, you know, could steal some more and is just an accruer of plate appearances. So... I know that's not what you want on your tombstone, crew or plate appearances. That does not sound like an impassioned defense. It's definitely nothing like my Luis Urias screed, but it is something that is in J.P. Crawford's favor.
Has a starting job, doesn't seem to have a lot of in-house competition to lose that playing time. So I think that bodes really well for J.P. Crawford in very deep formats. Yeah, it's mono league, it's AL only, it's 20-team super deep mix leagues, and it's just being good enough to rack
up. I traded for him in Devil's Rejects because we just didn't have a shortstop.
are you happy with your decisions?
I only traded a fourth round draft pick after a keep 28 in a 20-team keeper, so I didn't spend that much.
That's not that bad. One other note on the way out the door, Bryce Terang, shortstop eligible in NFBC leagues, could be a cheap source of speed, probably more of a utility guy with the way the Brewers roster is built at the present time. You never know. Showed a little pop last year at AAA. I want to see more power before I believe in it. If you're drafting Terang, it's because you're looking for some very late, very inexpensive stolen bases. A lot coming up next week on the show. We got our second base preview set to run on Monday, and then on Tuesday, we'll have our first show, our new prospect-centric show with our buddy Chris Welsh. So we got that to look forward to. Going to roll position previews out between now and I believe it's the end of February 17th is the last day. So we're going to have those kind of mixed in with some of our other draft strategy episodes. So if you've got episodes you haven't heard yet, ones that we've talked about, they probably haven't been released at this time, but they're coming. They've been recorded. We still got catchers and utility players to get to, got the whole outfield coming up in the near future.
Monday,
as well.
I'm recording an interview with a prime fantasy baseball sleeper. So that should be exciting.
Looking forward to that
as well. The hint is shirts off.
I kind of wish this player was Canadian because then you could use the tarps off. The hockey chirp. Fantastic. All right, we're going to go. $2 a month gets you in the door with a subscription. TheAthletic.com/ratesandbarrels is a great time of year to do that. If you got a question for a future episode, send those our way via email, ratesandbarrels@TheAthletic.com. Eno's on Twitter, @EnoSaris. I am @DerekVanRyan. But it's going to do it for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We're back with you next week.
Thanks for listening.